Good afternoon. This is Bob Kruger with Thought for Food for September 2012. This program is heard on the third Wednesday of the month at 4 p.m. and repeated on the third Saturday of the month at 3 p.m. It is intended for a blind or print-impaired audience, but hopefully will be of interest to everyone. September is a special month in my relationship with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. On September 12, 1985, I was behind the microphone reading for the first time on the Reading Service Network. The late Len Hogue guided this beginner through his first attempt as a reader. Now, after having read for 27 years, I still look forward to Wednesday mornings, my time to read the news and do the food ads program. Over these years, many of you who listen have been kind with both compliments and suggestions. So if you will continue to be so kind, I would like to continue to share Wednesday mornings with you. It's my pleasure. In previous programs, we discussed the drought in parts of our country and the effect it may have on food prices. If it is true that farmers only remember their worst years and their best ones, 2012 will stand out in their memories for a long time. For corn growers in the drought-plagued Midwest, it may be one of the worst. For those who grow corn in North Carolina, it looks like one of the best. Once in a while, we get a blue moon, said Ron Heininger, a corn specialist at North Carolina State University who's based at a research station in Plymouth in Washington County. It looks like that's what's going to happen this year. We've got the confluence of a good crop and good prices, and it only happens once in a while. Corn prices on futures markets have hit record highs this summer based on fears that up to 15% of the crop grown in the Midwest will be lost because of widespread drought. Final numbers won't be known until all the crop is harvested. The high prices have generated stress among livestock farmers in North Carolina and elsewhere because feed, made mostly from corn and soybeans, make up some 70% of the cost of raising pigs and chickens, both major agricultural products in the state. North Carolina producers import two-thirds of the grain used to feed livestock here because the state is a bit player in the nation's production of feed corn. Of the 96.4 million acres of corn that the United States Department of Agriculture says were planted in the United States this year, less than 1% was in North Carolina. Still, Heininger said the state has more than 2,000 registered corn growers, and some of them expanded their corn acreage this year because of strong prices last year. Mostly, that will pay off. Except for an area in the Piedmont between Raleigh and Greensboro and another around Stanley and Union counties, that didn't get enough rain, and a few spots near the coast that were blistered by July heat, most growers have enjoyed adequate rain in the absence of widespread diseases and insects. The North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services forecasted that North Carolina corn farmers would harvest 114 bushels per acre on the average, up 30 bushels per acre from last year and above the 10-year average. In some areas, Heininger say may see yields of as high as 300 bushels an acre. In some parts of the Midwest, farmers are expecting 124 bushels an acre, which is dismal by their standards. Farming is a game of averages, growers say. While the best and worst are the most memorable, they succeed or fail on averages. If you look at it over 5 years, you'll have two good years, you'll have two bad years, and you'll have 1 year that's just okay. It will be several weeks before North Carolina's growers have their crop harvested, and many will be anxious until it's all gathered and stored. Corn harvesting coincides with what is often the most active part of the Atlantic hurricane season, and much of the corn is grown near the coast, where it can be blown over by high winds and drowned by heavy rains. There's a lot of money standing in these fields, Heininger said. We've just got to get it in the bin. This is another example of how much farming success depends on factors beyond what the farmer controls. Just as you're ready to tuck into a nice three-egg omelet again, comforted by the reassuring news that eggs aren't so bad for you, here comes a study warning that for those over 40, the number of egg yolks consumed per week accelerates the thickening of arteries almost as severely as does cigarette smoking. The study, published recently in the journal Atherosclerosis, measures the carotid wall thickness, a key indicator of heart disease risk of 1,231 patients referred to a vascular prevention clinic, and ask each to detail a wide range of their health habits, from smoking and exercise to the consumption of egg yolks. Just as smoking is often tallied as pack years, the number of cigarette packs smoked per day for how many years, egg yolk consumption was tallied as egg yolk years, the number of egg yolks consumed each week times the number of years they were eaten. The study subjects were typically referred to the clinic after having suffered a stroke or a mini stroke, in which symptoms may disappear quickly, but which often presages a more serious stroke to come. For those whose consumption of whole eggs was in the highest 20%, the narrowing of the carotid artery was on the average about two-thirds of that of the study's heaviest smokers. We believe our study makes it imperative to reassess the role of egg yolks and dietary cholesterol in general as a risk for coronary heart disease, the study authors write. One-third of a second. That's how long a federal inspector will have to examine slaughtered chickens for contaminants and disease under new rules proposed by the federal government. The proposal would speed up production lines as much as 25%. It would also pull most federal inspectors off lines and replace them with plant workers. The USDA says its proposal is a win-win-win proposition that will modernize food inspections while saving money for taxpayers and the poultry industry. The nation's most recognized food safety and consumer groups, however, say the plan would leave gaping holes in oversight that will endanger the nation's food supply, not to mention create a conflict of interest for poultry plants. They warn that Americans who eat about 80 pounds of poultry a year will be at greater risk of getting a side serving of fecal contamination or cancerous tumors along with their chicken. I went out and bought a food processor so we could make more vegetarian meals, said Felicia Nestor, a food safety advocate and consultant with the Governmental Accountability Project. If those changes go into effect, my husband and I will no longer buy chicken. The USDA's Food Safety Inspection Service, which oversees poultry plants, believes the changes would ensure and even enhance the safety of the poultry supply by focusing our inspectors' efforts on activities more directly tied to improving food safety. The FSIS spokesman, Dirk Philpott, said in a statement. The agency said it wants inspectors to focus on issues that pose the greatest health risks to the public. The USDA has not said when it will make its final decision on the proposal. The new system would be voluntary, although the Food Safety Inspection Service expects all but the smallest poultry plants to opt in. Advocates say that's because the other option would prohibit those plants from remaining competitive in the industry. The biggest changes would be to use workers in chicken and turkey plants to replace all but one federal inspector on the conveyor belt, where the bad birds are removed from the production line. Currently, chicken plants have as many as four federal inspectors on the lines. It would let the poultry plants decide how much training their workers receive in identifying diseased or defective birds. It would enable plants to speed up their slaughter lines so that the sole federal inspector stationed at the end of the line would be required to view up to 175 birds per minute. The maximum speed is now 140 per minute, and the workload is divided among four inspectors so that it averages 35 birds per minute for each inspector. These new proposals will let poultry plants decide which dangerous bacteria for which they will test carcasses and how often they test. Rules will no longer plants to test for E. coli. At least one Georgia poultry plant owner isn't sold on the concept. Will Harris, owner of White Oaks Pastures in Bluffton, said he likes having an unbiased third party closely examine each chicken that comes through his production lines. I don't want to be the fox guarding the hen house, Harris said, whose farm is about 75 miles south of Columbus, Georgia. Harris also raises grass-fed cattle and sheep, and his operation is one of a few that handles its own slaughter on site. Having had the experience of walking through a poultry processing plant. I have trouble with the idea of cutting the number of people inspecting the chickens who are not responsible to the plant for their paychecks. If there ever was an opportunity for a conflict of interest, these new poultry plant proposals offer great opportunities. Can diet sodas really make you gain weight? Recent headlines report that diet sodas can lead to weight gain have stirred up debate among health experts. While zero-calorie diet sodas have been a dieter's best friend for decades, recent research brings up the question, do they really work? Two studies presented in June 2011 at the American Diabetes Association's scientific sessions suggest that diet soda may not help battle pounds or diabetes. Researchers from the University of Texas showed data that diet soft drink consumption is associated with a 70% greater waist circumference, a risk factor for type 2 diabetes compared with non-users. In the second study, the researchers found that the artificial sweetener aspartame raised the blood sugar in diabetes-prone mice. These findings coincide with other recent studies that have found negative health results associated with drinking diet soda. In a January 2012 study, the daily diet soda intake, at least one each day, was linked with an increased risk for vascular events such as a stroke. The research on diet soda and weight is far from conclusive. A March 2012 study in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition linked switching high-calorie drinks such as regular soda for calorie-free drinks like water or diet soda to weight loss. The switch from high-calorie drinks causes sufficient reduction in calories to provide a 2% body weight loss over 6 months. Why are these findings so confusing? We would expect the consumption of zero-calorie beverages to be uniformly linked to weight loss. The answer may be simply that obese people drink a lot of diet soda, which would explain the association between diet soda intake and greater weight in obese populations. The diet soda may encourage high-calorie intake of other food groups, the old diet soda and brownie habit. If people think they've been good by drinking diet soda, they may indulge in high-calorie treats to reward themselves. For now, your best bet is to keep your diet soda habit under control, maybe to drink more of the best zero-calorie beverage you can find, plain water, or unsweetened coffee or tea. This information came from Environmental Nutrition, which is an independent newsletter written by nutritious experts. And here's a related story. On the warmest of days, nothing beats the heat like an icy beverage. Frozen drinks are everywhere, from Starbucks to McDonald's to the nearest gas station. The Quick Trip website offers more than 10 frozen drink choices, and some of the newer stores promise as many as 20 frozen drink options. But some of these cool drinks can pack a lot of calories, some topping more than 600 calories, and put a chill on your efforts to slim down. So how does ice, just frozen water, get so fattening? Jennifer Teamsay, a clinical dietitian, said all that creaminess, added sugars and syrups, and enormous drink sizes add up to a lot of hidden calories. Still, experts say it's okay to indulge in an occasional frozen treat, and it's possible to revel in them on a more regular basis, especially if you make them yourself. Here are some tips from Ms. Say and from Marissa Moore, spokeswoman for the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, on enjoying frozen drinks and avoiding calorie-laden landmines. A 16-ounce caramel frappuccino from Starbucks has 410 calories, 15 grams of fat, and 64 grams of sugar. You can slim down a little by going for a light caramel frappuccino, lightly blended of the same size for 104 calories, no fat, and 29 grams of sugar. To really slim it down, go with an iced coffee for zero calories. Add a pump of syrup for about 20 calories. I do think it's good that Starbucks has the light option, and that is not that much, especially if that's your only indulgence during the day, Say said. These drinks are usually non-fat, so just recognize that most of the calories are probably from sugar. I have absolutely no problem at all with iced coffee. Made with real fruit, smoothies can have some redeeming value, but the serving size is important. Smoothie King offers the smoothies in three sizes, a 20-ounce, a 32-ounce, and a 40-ounce. A 20-ounce Angel food smoothie with strawberries, bananas, soy protein, and turbinado sugar contained 254 calories. But if you fill up a 40-ounce Angel Food smoothie, it packs a whopping 708 calories. Smoothies wear a health halo, leading many to believe they're harmless, Moore said. However, a 20-ounce fruit smoothie can run as much as 500 calories. You have to be a bit of a detective to outsmart frozen drinks. Look out for these code words: whipped cream, creamy, drizzled with anything, decadent, and opt out of the whipped cream to save calories. Don't make it a daily habit. If you're going to have a full calorie spurge, make an occasional indulgence of no more than once a week. Have you thought of making it yourself? Turn your smoothie craving into a healthy way to eat by making smoothies at home with seasonal fruit and ice. And consider adding non-fat yogurt. And if you are feeling adventurous, add spinach or kale to the blender to pump up the nutrients. I may be wrong, but the idea of adding some sort of leafy greens to a fruit smoothie, I'm afraid, would turn me off of smoothies for good. My cool drink for warm days is ice water with a bit of lime or lemon juice. Not all of the crop damage is a result of the lack of rain. North Carolina's mountain farmers may have lost 89% of their apple crop, usually worth $24 million to the state. Official numbers won't be available until the first of the month, but a combination of early spring that caused trees to bloom and a late cold snap hit orchards hard in Henderson County, which produces 85% of the state's crop. But because of the way cold air moves through mountain valleys, not every farm was hit. It's real spotty, said Peggy Lauder of the North Carolina Apple Growers Association. We were froze out, losing 90% of our crop, but some farms around her fared better. Dave Butler, owner of Skytop Orchard near Flat Rock, said his farm escaped damage and he expects to have a full crop. Skytop, which is a little more than 100 miles from Charlotte, is a popular destination for mountain visitors. It's nothing I particularly did, he said. It's actually something his ancestors did. They planted the trees on the top of a mountain, and cold air sinks, so Butler's trees mostly escaped damage while the cold air drained down into the valleys below him and hit the farms at lower elevations. That's also making it difficult to determine how extensive the damage is, says Marvin Owings, the Henderson County Extension Director. In 2010, the most recent available data, North Carolina's apple crop was the seventh largest in the nation, and the state usually is in the top 10 for apple-producing states. Other states had apple losses, too, including New York, Michigan, and Washington State. Crops in Pennsylvania and Virginia weren't hit as hard. And while some damage in North South Carolina, most of the state's apples are okay. Catherine Guzman at Windy Hill Orchard in York, South Carolina, said they'll open for pick your own on August 25th. The apples are ready, she said. We did all right. We didn't have a freeze. The 51st South Carolina Apple Festival was observed in Westminster off of I-85 west of Clemson over the Labor Day weekend. In addition to food and apple vendors, there was a 5K run, a rodeo, and a golf tournament. The apple emphasis focused on the popular varieties such as Gala, Red, and Gold Delicious, and Granny Smith. In Henderson County, Owings emphasized there will still be apples for the North Carolina Apple Festival in Henderson, August 13th to September 3rd, the traditional opening of the apple season, and for roadside stand. But some of U-Pick farms may not be open. U-Pick can bring a lot of loss from apples getting dropped on the ground or wasted. Still, everyone involved in growing apples encourages mountain travelers to check www.ncapple.com and call farms before you go. Come on and find your apples, Lauder said. Even though it is now the beginning of fall, we can still expect some warm days. Good partners in the kitchen now can be lemons or limes. They serve so many purposes you can't go wrong by buying one or the other every time you shop. Both are rich sources of vitamin C, and they also provide potassium in smaller amounts of some B vitamins such as folate and thiamine. They're low in calories, low in sodium and saturated fat, and they don't appear on the Environmental Working Group's list of the most pesticide-contaminated foods. But most of us don't eat lemons or limes by the slice or the chunk for the very reason we like them. They're so full of flavor and zing that just a squirt of their juices contributes concentrated flavor, serving as a condiment on many foods and flavoring for plain water or seltzer. The tartness and fresh sweet flavors of lemon and lime juice make them ideal substitutes for sugar and salt on many entrees, salads, and side dishes. Though each has a flavor of its own, lemons and limes are similar enough in flavor and pucker power that you can often use them interchangeably in recipes, and here are a few ways to use them. Season your cooked vegetables without adding butter or salt. Squeeze fresh lemon juice over steamed broccoli, kale, or Brussels sprouts. Add some olive oil and balsamic vinegar too. Fresh lime or lemon juice tastes great on baked sweet potatoes. Add light fresh flavor to salads by spritzing fresh lemon juice or lime juice over greens, or squeeze generously into the oil and herb mixtures for homemade salad dressing. That's better than anything you can buy in a bottle. Fresh lime juice is good over papaya or avocado slices. Add slices of lemon to seafood or casseroles. Squeeze lemon juice over the dish first, then toss the wedges into the mix. Slice lemons and limes to add color to plates, so use them as garnishes. Of course, their juice also serves as a practical function of delaying browning when tossed with apple, pear, and banana slices. Keep a couple in your fruit bowl. It's unlikely they'll spoil before you find a way to use them. This advice comes from our friend Suzanne Havila Hobbs. We have mentioned anniversaries lately. August 15th was the 100th anniversary of the birth of Julia Childs, and she made the idea of French cooking popular in our country by her at-ease manner on TV. If she made a mistake, she didn't try to cover up. She just said she goofed. Her candor made her a flavor of those who admired that part of her personality. How we would like to say, happy 100 years, Julia. Not all economic news is bad. Food manufacturer Valley Fine Foods announced in July that it will open a new East Coast manufacturing facility in Rutherford County and create at least 350 jobs over the next 3 years. The Napa Valley, California-based company, which makes pasta dishes under the Past Prima brand, is locating a new plant in Forest City, about 75 miles west of Charlotte. Valley Fine Foods was awarded a state incentive package worth $2.78 million if it meets hiring and investment goals. The average wage will be $31,636 plus benefits, slightly above the Rutherford County average of $28,172. This grant will allow us to better serve our customers on the East Coast and help us further expand our product line, said Ryan Tu, the president and CEO of Valley Fine Foods, in a statement. This manufacturing facility is the third major economic project to locate in Forest City in recent years. Horsehead Corporation announced last September that it will bring a zinc recycling facility to Forest City and create 250 jobs. And Facebook recently held a grand opening of its new $450 million data center in the town. It is the first of three buildings the company is expected to build at its site in Forest City. The tens of thousands of servers will house much of the daily traffic produced by the social network company's more than 845 million users. A second Facebook building is expected to be completed later this year. Facebook is eligible for North Carolina state tax breaks and will receive up to $11.4 million in incentives from Rutherford County. I'm sure that the Forest City industry hunters are very good at their job, but it seems to me that we're dealing with a culture where we have to pay someone to come to our communities where they find willing and capable employees. Even though we'll have some very warm days in September, the signs of autumn are showing up. A few leaves are beginning to fall, and along I walk are some wooded lots. The orange persimmons are ripening. If I can find enough of them, I have a great recipe for persimmon pudding. And as the salesman in the Ocean Spray cranberry juices say, it's tasty. I've also found some fox grapes, a species of wild grape that years ago Mr. Welch domesticated into today's Concord grapes. We're constantly warned about safe handling of food in our kitchens, and food safety expert Mark Nealon suggests you do what he does in his own home. Sanitize with heat. When he uses tongs to put raw poultry or meat on the grill, he also places the tips of the tongs on the grill, then closes the lid, leaving the handles outside. The intense heat zaps the bacteria, so he can safely use the same tongs to remove the cooked food. People usually don't wash fruits such as melons before cutting into them, but such produce grows in the dirt, and your knife can easily transfer pathogens such as the deadly listeria that recently contaminated cantaloupes from the rind to the flesh. So avoid buying pre-cut produce and give all the fruits and vegetables a thorough cleaning with a produce brush before slicing. Place some vinegar in a spray bottle and give your produce a spritz. Wait 30 seconds and then rinse thoroughly. Put cooked food away promptly and never contaminate food with your hands or utensils that have been in your mouth. Refrigerated cooked food within 2 hours after cooking. Otherwise, toss it. Sanitize with boiling water. Before he cooks, Mr. Nealon puts a pot of water on the stove. That's the way it's ready to purge germs from utensils and sponges before and after he uses them. When he's done, he dumps the water in the sink to clean it. In the past few years, we've heard a lot about community gardens. Now a New York company has developed a hyper way to get fresh produce to grocery stores. Grow it on the store's own rooftop, or at least very close by. Bright Farms builds hydroponic, that's growing in water, greenhouses on tops of buildings, and then sells the lettuce, tomatoes, and herbs to local supermarkets. So far, the company's partners include A&P in Brooklyn, Whole Foods in New Jersey, and Homeland Foods in Oklahoma. Now Bright Foods wants to come to the Triangle. Right now, it's looking for an ideal site and holding a contest to find it. If you know of a perfect spot that would meet the company's needs and can describe your vision in 200 words or less, you could win $1,000. The requirements are 50,000 to 200,000 square feet of unused space, ideally on a rooftop, either on or very close to a supermarket in Raleigh or Durham. Urban lots would also be considered. And here's the deal. Bright Farms finances, builds, and manages the greenhouse farms. The supermarkets sign a 10-year contract to purchase the produce and receive a guarantee that prices will never exceed inflation. What an idea. We all like to snack, but one of the biggest problems with snack is quite simply they typically consist of high calorie unhealthy foods rather than nutrient-dense healthy foods, with fresh fruit all too frequently replaced by juice and other sugary drinks. With more candy and less milk, the prize for the biggest increase in snack foods over the last 30 years goes to chips and crackers. What's clearly not lacking in snacking is salt and sugar. Snacking can and should play an important part in a child's daily diet. The right approach to snacking helps kids from getting hungry and cranky while driving, giving them added energy and, if you plan it right, added nutrients. By following simply smart advice, you can help your child grow better, think better, and stay active throughout the day and throughout childhood. Snacks should not be an exception to the rule that food in general should have nutritional value. Make sure you commit to applying the same noble goals in choosing your snacks as you do for your child's meals. Keep finger foods on hand. Finding foods that are quick and easy to grab and serve is actually quite easy. Simply cut up fresh fruits or vegetables. Keep whole grain, crackers, pretzels, or ready-to-eat, preferably low-sugar, high-fiber cereals on hand. And until next month at this time, this has been Bob Krueger with September's program, A Thought for Food. Take care.